practicing in Burma with Sayadaw Upandita in the beginning of 2016, just a few months before he passed away. One of the things he told us all during a Dharma talk one night was this, I guess, saying they have in Sri Lanka. So in Sri Lanka, the bhikkhus, and perhaps bhikkhunis now also, I hope, in the villages, they have these platforms that the monastics go and sit on to eat after they collect their alms and their alms bowls. So the monastics go out every day and they collect food from the lay people and they take it in their alms bowls to these platforms. And Sayadaw Upandita said that it was said that there is no such platform in Sri Lanka on which a monastic has not become enlightened. So, of course, in that tradition, which we are the beneficiaries of, with Sayadaw Upandita being the teacher of many of our teachers, and his teacher was Mahasi Sayadaw, so we benefit from that lineage. There's this strong emphasis on the continuity of mindfulness. But Sayadaw Upandita was, particularly highlighting this eating meditation as a powerful vehicle for coming awake. So I'm going to talk tonight about eating meditation. And I just want to emphasize that, I went to practice with Sayadaw Upandita. I actually had a sense, like he was quite old, and he had his teachings and his books had really affected me, and I had benefited a lot from the teachings that he had given to my teachers. And I knew he was in his 90s, so I went all the way to Burma and practiced. So there are a lot of natural processes that are involved in our practice. And one of these is actually the conditions that come into play as the teachings are passed down. The teachings are given from one practitioner to another. And we can actually observe this as a part of our practice, that as the teachings are passed down, they're not owned by anyone. They're part of a natural process. They play into the teachings entered into my heart-mind process through various means. They entered into the other teachers' heart-minds. They touch yours. You touch each other's as you practice together. So this is one of the natural processes involved in the Dharma that we can observe. And there are a lot of natural processes also involved in all of our daily activities. But with practicing with eating meditation, we can really see a lot of these with particular clarity. Perhaps because there's such strong, pleasant, and unpleasant experiences, and such strong experiences through all of the sense doors, we can bring all of the four foundations of mindfulness into our practice with eating meditation. So I'm going to go through this broad overview of how one could practice, what one might notice, what one could practice with in a period of eating meditation, beginning really before we enter the dining hall. And so it's going to bring in a lot of the teachings that we've had before. But I also want to talk about a teaching that a few teachers have touched on, but not particularly in depth, and that's the five aggregates. So these are going to come into play as I talk about eating meditation also. And Dhara mentioned the five aggregates yesterday, and some of the aggregates have come up in some of the teachings. But the five aggregates are a map, essentially, that the Buddha talked about of our experience. That our experience, our conditioned experience, consists of five sort of heaps of experience. That's the way that aggregates is sometimes, that's one of the translations of that word. The word, the Pali word being khanda. And the five aggregates are what the Buddha said we can see through our practice are not self. In fact, he said they were not fit to be regarded as self, and I'll talk about that a little bit more. The first aggregate is the body or form. The second aggregate is perception, which a number of teachers have talked about, and Brian talked about this morning. And it's that function of the mind to categorize experience. It happens automatically. and we can really bring our attention to that. As Brian mentioned, that function of the mind can be involved in implicit bias, but it's happening all the time in all of our experience. The third aggregate is vedana, which you're all familiar with from the teachings here, the pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant tone that comes along with everything that arises in every sense door. And the fourth is mental or volitional formations. The word for that in Pali is sankhara. And one manifestation of these is can be thought of perhaps as an amalgam of the other mental experiences that we have that don't involve simply perception, vedana, and consciousness, which is the fifth aggregate. Volitional formations also includes intention. And I know Greg talked about practicing with intention earlier in the retreat. So what the Buddha taught and what we can see in our practice is not simply just that these are not self, but that they're not fit to be regarded as self. Why? Because they are ephemeral. They're passing away. When they arise, they pass away. They're ungovernable. We're not willing them into existence. They're happening because of causes and conditions. So what the Buddha was pointing to was how can we either logically or once we see actually the function of these, the impermanence of them, and the fact that we don't control them, how can we take them to be self? They don't have the qualities that one could, they don't have the permanent qualities or the controllable qualities that one could actually believe them to be a self. So the Buddha used these great similes to describe how each of the aggregates sort of show up and how they show up in their not-self quality. And I think they're really evocative, so I want to just mention them. I can't go into this, the five aggregates teaching in too much depth, but I do want to give it a little bit of evocativeness in terms of describing what they're like and what we can see in our experience. So the body is like a lump of, is like sea foam, according to the Buddhist teachings. It's not solid. It's an ever-changing process, and just the way that foam on a wave is shifting and changing all the time. It doesn't have the substance that we take it to. And vedana is like water bubbles arising and bursting on the surface of water. So this just popping in and out of our experience. Oh, pleasant. Oh, next minute, second unpleasant. Neither pleasant nor unpleasant. They're just popping in and out of experience like bubbles on the surface of water. Perception is like a mirage. It's the mind goes out and categorizes experience, and it's creating sort of a separation in doing that. It's solidifying our experience, when in fact what that experience is shifting and changing, even as it's passing through our sense doors. Mental formations or volitional formations are like a plantain tree. So we have to, so many of us aren't familiar with plantain trees, but this was something familiar at the time of the Buddha. And what a plantain tree is, stem is hollow. So it has coils on the outside, but the inside is hollow. So our mental formations actually don't have the solidity that we think they do, our intentional formations. And consciousness, which is the fifth aggregate, and the one that I really, that wouldn't, you might not come up so easily in practice and won't come up as I'm really talking about eating meditation, but consciousness, the Buddha described as like a magic trick. So in referring to consciousness here, he's referring to the consciousness that arises with every when every object makes contact with a sense door. At the same time, a consciousness arises that knows that that object at the sense door. And because we don't see the impermanence of consciousness, we don't see that it's simply arising and passing with every contact at the sense doors. It performs like a magic trick so that we have a sense of permanence out of actually experience that is ephemeral and passing away. So the Buddha, it's important to emphasize that the Buddha taught that these aggregates are not fit to be regarded as self. He actually didn't, in answering, in being asked the question whether there was a self or not a self, he refused to answer the question. So it's interesting to think about that in terms of questions or ways in which our mind might begin to analyze that actually don't lead to liberation or don't lead to awakening or happiness. The Buddha repeatedly kind of refused to answer questions that he thought didn't lead to the end of suffering. And if we think about it, if we get caught up in an idea of whether or not there is a self or not a self, there's a certain suffering in that. There's a certain trying to analyze or figure out the situation. And also a mulling over self in a way. So in practicing with all of these aggregates, the focus can really be on what are they? How do they play out in our experience? And how can we, in seeing the impermanence or the uncontrollability of that, what does that say about those particular qualities rather than looking towards, like, is there a self or not a self? So we can drop the sort of analytical aspect of it and look to our direct experience. So turning to the eating meditation, which I hope to bring in all of these aspects of our experience and ways of practicing, it actually can begin with the first feeling of hunger. And let's say it's in the meditation hall. Let's say we're sitting and it's the sitting period before lunch. And something we call hunger arises in the body, right? But what is hunger? And we can explore and investigate that. What happens in the body? Is it sort of some vibrations or pressure that, and what's the vedana that comes along with that? Where is it located? Does it move around? Does what we call hunger, does it increase, decrease? And does it come in waves? And then what's can be really interesting to explore is this conditioning process whereby the body conditions the mind conditions the body. Sometimes I've had a lot of images of food sitting in the meditation hall. And oftentimes those images of food have immediately triggered like the mouth watering, right? And so fascinating to see how this will just, these will just, the images might just pop into the mind, disappear over time. And we can feel the anticipation. And so does that create a hindrance of sense desire in our practice? We can explore that. And of course, feeling the need for food and going to obtain food is a healthy, wholesome thing to do. But we can explore through this process of reacting to perhaps uncomfortable physical sensations that we call hunger, which are actually like a myriad of sensations. That's a whole conceptual label we put on it. That's perception. The mind saying, this is hunger, but what's actually happening? Right? And then and so the body and the mind condition each other in this process, and that sense desire might arise out of that. And we can look at whether or not there's actually a sort of a second arrow that's being, excuse me, a second arrow. The first arrow being the physical discomfort of that we call hunger. And then is there agitation in the wanting the food, or do we have relative equanimity with it? Are we able to be mindful of the process? And then the bell rings in the midst of maybe the hunger is not happening at that moment. Maybe the mind has totally gone on to some other preoccupation, you know. Or maybe the mind is in the midst of one of those hunger waves or with the accompanying thoughts when the bell rings. But I found it so interesting that I've spent a number of almost noontime sits with practicing with this process. And then when the bell rings, I'm either, you know, hopefully in mindfulness of something else or on another train of thought. So oftentimes these hunger waves have felt quite dramatic. But then it surprises me that there's peace in that moment when the bell's rung. And then we move out of the meditation hall and we're going through that strange funnel that is the bizarre architectural feature of IMS, which can tend to create this backlog. And we can watch the mind at that time. You know, is there greed in the mind related perhaps to the anticipation of the food? Or there can be all kinds of, in that bottleneck, perhaps, aversions, thoughts, judgments. Why are these Birkenstocks, where are my shoes? Somebody moved them. Why are these Birkenstocks constantly in my way? Why is there this funnel here that I can't get through at IMS? But one of the great things I think about eating meditation is that it's a particularly good area to practice with impatience. Impatience, which would involve these mental formations, volitional formations I was talking about. It just seems to come up as we're going through the whole process of moving from the meditation hall into the dining hall. Throughout the whole, perhaps, lunch period, there are possibilities for that. And one of the other things that Sayadaw Upandita said that really caught my attention during this retreat in Burma is just a single sort of one-liner teaching. And maybe it's common in Burma, that I don't know. But he said, just simply, impatience is a form of anger based on conceit. And I was so struck by this. First of all, for whatever reason, I'd never heard somebody describe impatience as a form of anger, but of course it is. There's this anger of not getting your way. And this sense of an expectation being thwarted. And it can happen with such minor, mundane things. Due to these, what are called sankhara, these are these volitional formations, conditions that have been set in place over our lifetime, perhaps previous lifetimes, if we believe in that, that come into play, that we're placed in a certain situation, there's something that we want, it's being thwarted, and the response is this anger. And I was really struck also by the fact that Sayadaw Upandita said this is based on conceit. So conceit has this particular meaning in the Dharma. I'm not sure if anyone's talked about it here. Probably someone has. Conceit, the Pali word for that is mana, M-A-N-A. And it refers to a comparing mind. It's the tendency of the mind to think of oneself either as better than, equal to, or less than. Just constantly comparing, constantly doing that. It's the self-creation. It seems it's a feature, sort of a necessary feature of this self-creation that we do constantly. And, you know, we see it, and all the time, and perhaps we, you know, not to get judgmental about it, it's actually the last fetter that is uprooted when someone is awakened. So it's hanging around for all of us, and that's why it's one of the reasons why it's so pervasive and we're so familiar with it. But I actually had, you know, taking that teaching, and then later, several weeks later, at actually a different center, I was practicing with impatience. I was so taken with this teaching. I was in the dining hall and I was waiting in a line, and I just saw the mind very clearly. I was behind two or three people to wash dishes, and I just saw the mind so clearly saying, "I should be up there." With that impatience contraction, "I should be up there." And there's that conceit. It was humorous to me at the time. It's so illogical, actually physically illogical. And also, but also kind of our hearts break sometimes when we see these tendencies in ourselves that also we know arise with others. Because faced with really the ungovernability of life, we resist it and get ourselves caught in suffering, even in the most, you know, mundane day-to-day activities of just moving about in a dining hall. So you can bring your attention, perhaps, to this experience of impatience, which is something that is pervasive as a kind of a root way in which we experience suffering. So we move from the dining hall, and now we're sort of in line. We're not up at the table yet. We're standing in line. Lots of people in front of us. Maybe impatience is arising, maybe not. And of course, you can do standing meditation and a form of walking meditation. This is a good opportunity, I think, to just practice with just noticing the extending of the limbs that take place and stepping forward. But because we're in this activity of being in the hall with so many other people, we can also practice really with seeing, with the sense door of seeing. So what conditions us taking a step forward? It's simply seeing the person in front of us moving. And we have no control over what's happening within the eye door, within the sense of seeing. The attention to step forward, why does that arise? Simply because of the condition of seeing the person moving step forward, the person ahead step forward. And so we can see again the way the body conditions the mind conditions the body. And this intention arises without our willful control. It's just arising out of these conditions. Very naturally, the body, the mind process is moving towards food, towards nourishment. Very naturally, we're in the company of other human beings. Very naturally, most of us, not all of us, have eye doors that are functioning very well. If the eye door is functioning, then that's what compels us forward after the intention arises. And so as we're moving up towards the table and starting to grasp hold of our plates and our starting to reach out towards the food, we can still continue to practice with this first foundation of mindfulness, the mindfulness of the body. And I after all these years of practice, it's really sweet to me, this practice of simply knowing the movements of the body, of extending the limbs, noticing the intentions that precede them, and simply extending the limbs and what one is doing with the body. And Jill read this, but I want to read it again, which is that part of the Satipatthana Sutta. It says, practitioners, when going forward and returning, they act clearly knowing. When looking ahead and looking away, they act clearly knowing. When flexing and extending the limbs, they act clearly knowing. When wearing their robes and carrying their outer robe and bowl, they act clearly knowing. When eating, drinking, consuming food, and tasting, they act clearly knowing. When defecating and urinating, they act clearly knowing. When walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent, they act clearly knowing. So there can be this peace of simply knowing the movements of the body. And I think that the context of eating meditation really points to the peace that can arise out of this practice. In the midst of all of these conditions that can tend to bring up greed, you know, seeing that dish that one really wants, and I don't know about you, but there's this part of my mind that even if I'm up towards the front of the line, is afraid that the food's going to disappear before I get there. There is a deep way in which food, we have a lot of conditioning around food. And so there can be a lot of relative, especially in this silent, intensive practice periods, there can be a relative amount of turmoil in the mind in terms of the greed arising and perhaps impatience, all kinds of judgments, whatever. And if we just rest into noticing the movement of the body as the arm is reaching to scoop some food out of the bowl, placing it on the bowl, noticing the intention then to step forward, noticing what's conditioning that, noticing the arm extending again, the hand gripping the spoon, putting some food on the plate, it can bring a peacefulness to the process where there's a knowing of the simple acts, and also resting into intention, because it's this antidote. Knowing our intentions as we're going through this process, sort of an antidote to letting the relative turmoil of the greed or the other things that might be coming up taking over the mind states, taking over the process. We can rest into that real sense of connection with the body, and that sense of connection with the simple intention of each movement, of each that gives rise to our various movements during that time. But I also want to just mention at this stage that I'm going through this overview of eating meditation, but I want to be, really aware that for a lot of people, there's really strong conditioning around food. So some people may have strong emotional reaction or emotional patterns that come up. It could be shame, could be various ideas about the body, what one should eat, what one shouldn't eat. And in that circumstance, you know, the best way to practice with eating meditation may be to do self-compassion practices during that time. Maybe to, you know, only find just a little, in terms of this whole overview of meditation, it's unlikely that really anyone would keep mindfulness going throughout this whole process and touch into all of these foundations that I'm talking about, all of the aggregates, etc. But this is hopefully a good overview of a few things that you might be able to catch and pay attention to. And if any of it is also something that you think is activating in terms of conditioning around food, to really know that there's all of these other practices that we can bring that are extremely powerful also self-compassion that we've been talking about and teaching, and I know that many of you have been practicing with, is also this doorway to liberation. So we're at the table and we're still putting food on our plates and get to the end of the table and then we have to go and find a table. And I love what Winnie said the other day about, oh, you know, you go through this process possibly sometimes, maybe not at this point in the retreat, but where you feel like you're a kindergartner and it's like, where are you supposed to sit and who are you supposed to sit with? And she's like, just go sit down. And I agree with that. And you may also notice, though, that you have an agenda in terms of which table you want to sit at. You want to sit by the window. You can bring mindfulness to all of those volitional formations that are arising. and as you walk up to your table, your seat, you can notice the hand extending and putting the plate on the table and sitting down in front of your plate. And at this point, wow, there can actually be a lot going on. The hunger at this point has reached. The hunger, the interplay of smells hitting the sense door, the sights of the food, has all conditioned, come together in all this mix of conditions to where there may be quite a strong pull in the mind towards this food. And it can be fruitful just to sit for that moment and at least take note of that. Take note of it. And so we reach out and pick up a utensil, fork or spoon, and place the spoon into the food. And see if, and one of the tricks of eating meditation is between bites to put the utensil down on your plate so that it's just slowing down the process. Because otherwise, the natural inclination of the mind is to just keep that fork or that spoon going. So from the beginning, you can try to slow down the process. Notice perhaps the first intention that arises to lift the utensil up to the mouth, and you can notice the anicca. There's so much opportunity for noticing anicca in this process. Even the sensation of the utensil on the mouth, there's a cascade of physical sensations that go on even in that moment. And then the food hits the tongue and there will be a burst of taste. This is practicing with that sense door. And immediate perception. The mind will label it. The mind will decide what it is. That's not happening. That's not governable by you. It may actually be that you anticipated it was going to taste like something else, and the mind labels it a completely different thing, and that's not a pleasant experience. You know, the pasta that tastes like lentils, something like that. We sometimes have this experience where it's not exactly what we wanted it to be, and then we begin chewing. And if we're practicing with just that peacefulness of being aware, clearly knowing the bodily movements, we can simply be practicing with noticing chewing. Chewing, chewing. Light mental notes during this whole process are helpful if that's something that works for you. But within the sensory experience that's happening in the mouth, there are constantly changing tastes, vedana, perception, textures. So we're chewing and the mind might go mushroom, and then the mind salt. And those sensations, perceptions can increase and decrease. And then we can notice the process of swallowing, which may happen faster than you might even realize. Fascinating, fascinating experience of a human being. arising clearly because of all of these conditions. At a certain point, the food comes to a point, a texture that the body-mind process has really through a natural process decides it's time to swallow, and boom, it swallows. And where does, and that's an interesting experience of what seems to be a somewhat of a disappearance. It's a movement of this food from a more sensate part of the body to a much less sensate part of the body. And it's anicca, gone, right? But actually, we can follow it through. I'll talk about that a little bit more, but I want to focus on the now on the process of continuing to do the eating. So hopefully we've set our utensil down on the plate. So there has probably been in the midst of this chewing already a desire to have another bite. It's arisen, and maybe we've noticed it and we haven't picked it up because we're trying to slow ourselves down. But we may notice that desire for to take another bite having arisen and passed away, even though we haven't swallowed yet. So we can pick up the utensil again and notice the mind as it just has these preferences to go back and forth between various dishes. All the judgments that are being made about the food. And we can continue this process, bringing mindfulness to each step, the intention to reach out again. I've spent a lot of time just kind of noticing, trying to notice that last intention to lift the utensil to the mouth, trying to catch it. So the swallowing, we notice that swallowing, and then actually there can be a sensation, there can be an awareness of that food moving through the body to some degree, especially if it's kind of warm food. A warm cup of tea is a good place to practice with noticing, with bringing mindfulness to the process of food moving through the body to some degree. You might notice, especially with a warm dish or a warm cup of tea, quite a lot of pleasantness in the throat, through the chest, through the stomach. We can start to bring awareness to more of the bodily experiences in this way. And notice, particularly if the food is very pleasant, how the mind wants to reach out and get another sip or another taste. And at some point during this meal, oftentimes there's some strategizing that happens as to how we're going to get something else. Right? Even in the midst of enjoying the cookie, the clinging thought arises of how are we going to get another one? Wanting another one, or maybe trying to talk ourselves out of it. Right? And what can we see here? One of the things we're seeing that the mind is noticing is that this pleasantness that I'm experiencing, this mind-body process is experience, is passing away. It's going to go away. It's already going away. And the mind kind of knows that. And there's a clinging thought of wanting another. And this is a noticing of one of the forms of dukkha, the dukkha of impermanence, in Pali called viparinama dukkha. You know, so in this process, we're understanding this characteristic of unsatisfactoriness and unreliability. And it consists of our reactions to unpleasant thing experiences, our difficult mind states. But it also exists in the pleasant experiences themselves because we know in a part of us that they're passing away. So there's all of these mind states going on, all conditioned, that are the reaction to us knowing the pleasant is passing away. So here's an area of seeing anicca that Sayadaw Upandita highlighted in eating meditation. He talked about, it seemed to me that what he was saying, well, this is particularly the area where the monastics became enlightened in Sri Lanka, sitting on the platforms with their alms bowls. It's the mixing of the curry with the rice. The mixing of the curry with the rice. You know, and here we have some curries and we have some rice or beans and rice. And many of us might mix them. But you might notice, even in this, you can see anicca. Definitely the food swirling, changing color, changing textures. It's practicing with the eye door. And then the mind wanting the mixture to get just right. So another way, just to mention this, to support the continuity of the eating meditation is to close your eyes while you're chewing. You might see a lot of practitioners doing this, but it really actually kind of does help highlight the taste sensations, the various things that the mind will be doing with having perception of different tastes, the pleasantness or unpleasantness as it's shifting and the changing textures. Just closing the eyes and going through the chewing process, noticing the swallowing perhaps more carefully. And the food moves through the body. And if we take a step back, the process of bringing mindfulness to eating also shows us not self in a different way. If we have a broader mindfulness of the whole process, because we're taking this external substance and putting it into what is our body. And then it's moving through and it's leaving eventually. So we see in this, you know, this is the body, one aspect of the body kind of being like foam in the sense that it's a constantly changing process. I mean, is that food in one's mouth when one is chewing, is that self? Is that the body then? Because it's there. This is the way Bhikkhu Anālayo talks about it. And he's talking about mindfulness of the elements, but I think this can really be seen through our practice with eating meditation also. He says, our existence is entirely dependent on the outside world, and both are merely changing processes. The division we tend to create between the elements in this body as something I am, and the manifestations of the elements outside the body as something substantially different from what I am, is being put into question. At what point exactly does it feel right to consider food to have become my body? Is it when I have it on my spoon, in my mouth when I chew, or when I swallow it? At what point does it lose the right to this qualification? When it leaves the stomach? When it proceeds from the small to the large intestine, or only when it is excreted? This notion that we have of the self is in fact a constantly changing process. So I mentioned that natural processes involved in the Dharma, and this is really pointing to that, that this is all a part of this natural process, and through this bringing mindfulness to eating and all the associated mind states and experiences with it, we see what we take to be ourselves as part of nature, as simply natural processes occurring. And I think actually in that there's love that arises also. It's poignant. It's poignant that we go through this over and over. All sentient beings have this experience of having constantly changing contacts at the sense doors, of experiencing conditions coming at them that they don't control, of the shifting of pleasant and unpleasant, and the tendency to falsely believe that if we can simply hold on to the pleasant or push away the unpleasant, that will bring the happiness, rather than starting to live aligned with these natural processes starting to understand and see truly the anicca, the impermanence in the contacts at the sense doors, and then the mental processes that follow. If we live aligned with an understanding of their impermanence, then we can have so much more ease in the process, not constantly trying to manipulate the experience in a way that's trying to create permanence or push away things that can't be, that are simply unpleasant, but are passing away. So after the meal, you can kind of check in with the attitude in the mind. Has it suddenly come up with something else at once? I mean, so it's interesting. The mind has this way of doing that. It's very preoccupied, perhaps, with wanting food at one point, and then there might be another idea of a strategy for creating pleasant experience. And again, I just want to emphasize in going through this whole process overview of eating meditation, you can just touch in with mindfulness in any of these areas, not to demand of yourself a certain level of continuity of mindfulness throughout the whole process. Because we don't control, just as any other mental formation, we don't control when mindfulness arises. We put in place the conditions for mindfulness to arise more in the future by practicing it on the cushion, off the cushion. And that creates karmic consequences where mindfulness will arise again in the future, more likely. So you might be standing in line and there's no mindfulness, and then suddenly it arises and you can celebrate that moment and then bring mindfulness to what's happening in that moment. I think Winnie mentioned that earlier. There's two causes, well, the proximate cause of a moment of mindfulness. There's two things: previous moment of mindfulness and strong perception. So mindfulness simply arises because we've set in place the causes and conditions. And if it hasn't, we don't have control over that either. So to have this relaxed and interested attitude towards practice at all times, knowing that everyone in this room has put in tremendous effort, actually courageous effort, to bring about the conditions where that mindfulness will arise more in the future. And it's actually a lawful process that it will. It's another natural process. And that's what I really want to emphasize towards the end here, is that the process of mindfulness and the cultivation of the factors of awakening is also natural. So the mind lets go of clinging because we set in place those conditions. And we can see that too in the practice. Mindfulness is just another mental formation, isn't it? Just another part of the mental formations. So is the loving kindness that really fuels our ability to practice. And so are the intentions that can arise that are really more wholesome in this process. The intentions to bring mindfulness and care to the process. The intentions to notice impatience and not to just act out on it in a way. The intentions to notice how it harms us or how it might harm others. It's all a part of a natural process that we've set in place that will help us to let go of that clinging and the false identification with these ephemeral experiences, that will help shine clarity on the fact that these aggregates are not, how could we take them to be self? They're not fit to be regarded as self. They can't define us. You know, how can a moment of a bubble bursting of a pleasant experience that's passing away, we have this tendency to decide that self. We have this tendency of the mind to react and to hold on to it and think this is self. How can a perception of mushroom that comes and goes in a poof, how could that be fit to be regarded as self? How could a moment of impatience that arises that we really don't even want to be there out of some mundane experience that we can even see as illogical on one level, how could that be fit to be regarded as self? So in that way, we can get a lot more space, start to make that more space between us and these passing physical and mental experiences. So I was a little worried, I don't know if I'm so worried anymore, but I was a little worried as I was writing this, preparing this talk, that it would be perhaps too much information or might be a lot of instruction on how to bring mindfulness to a whole series of events. And so I wanted to really bring in a spacious quote, one that reminds that mindfulness and the process of coming awake is natural too. So I'm going to read one of these sweet quotes from Ajahn Chah. Let me make sure I'm finding the right one, actually. So I might have not kept it. Ah, there it is. This is also a reminder just to practice with mindfulness with a lot of care towards your own natural pace, towards where you are in the practice. In fact, Ajahn Chah, so he said, each person has his own natural pace. Some of you will die at 50, some at age 65, and some at age 90. So too, your practice will not all be identical. Don't think or worry about this. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become quieter and quieter in any surroundings. It will become still like a clear forest pool. Then all kinds of wonderful and rare animals will come to drink at the pool. You will see clearly the nature of all things in the world. You will see many wonderful and strange things come and go, but you will be still. Problems will arise and you will see through them immediately. This is the happiness of the Buddha. So take it easy if you do eating meditation. Do it with kindfulness. That's one of Ajahn Brahm's words for mindfulness. And lots of relaxation and interest. So I'll just let the words dissolve in the air. And just sit for a minute. may all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. May they know freedom from suffering.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.